Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, an expert weighs in on Georgia's primary election results.
Most everything else trended the way I guess we'd expect, including voter turnout. We did set a record for voter turnout in a primary election.
Then, a local historian's book will be read by student athletes this summer.
When the news comes at you quickly, NPR's Morning Edition slows it down to make sense of what matters. Stay connected to the facts with Morning Edition every weekday.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Millions of Georgians voted in the primary and nonpartisan general election held on May 19th. While many contests were decided on election night, other key races will advance to a runoff election in June, including the Republican candidate for Georgia's next governor. Dr. Jeffrey Glass is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss the election results, what surprised him, and what he'll pay attention to as races advance to runoffs this summer. Here's that conversation.
Can we start with a sort of broad question? Were there any outcomes that surprised you during this latest primary at the state or local level?
Well, that's a good question. Generally speaking, not really. I was really kind of hoping for something more exciting to happen out of our primaries this time around. In terms of the actual offices themselves, we expected most stuff to go to primary, to runoffs. I think I expected the same thing to happen with the Democratic Party as far as the governor's race goes, going to a runoff. That didn't happen, so I guess that's a little bit of a surprise. But generally speaking, I feel like across the board, most of this is going the way I think the general talking heads and political community expected it to go. Runoff for the governor's office and the Republican Party and the Senate, too. But otherwise, I guess a little bit of a surprise that Derek Dooley did so well. And most everything else trended the way I guess we'd expect, including voter turnout. We did set a record for voter turnout in a primary election for Georgia. 27.9% voter turnout, which is again not atypical. It is low. If you consider like record turnouts less than a third, and you kind of break that in half between the two political parties. But yeah, it's not all that unexpected.
What explains generally kind of lower turnout during primaries?
Well, we have a lot of reasons why voter turnout's historically generally low in the United States. This is a long-term thing we've been dealing with for several decades now. Some of this is that it is difficult in certain states to vote. The cost of voting varies from one state to another in the sense that, some states are a little more open in what documents are required, what types of identification are acceptable. For example, if you're out west, most voter ID type laws out west involve you can use your concealed carry permit or a hunting license, a utility statement, anything with your name and address on it, as opposed to the handful of state issued and costly forms of photo identification we require in Georgia. So that does have some impact. I mean, right off the bat, a little over 400,000 who would otherwise be eligible adults for voting don't have that ID. And procuring ID is not as free as many people expect it to be. That said, there's a lot of other reasons why we have low voter turnout in the United States as well as Georgia. We have a lot of elections, so sometimes there's a little bit of fatigue. When you're thinking about the elections themselves, we generally think about presidential elections as having the highest. It's the most visible, most salient election that we're going to have in the United States. And we have seen an uptick there, 60% plus in the past two presidential elections, which is pretty significant for us. Kind of thinking about the historic voter turnout rates for the United States prior to 2020, 54% was pretty typical. Midterms, a little less so. I mean, most people don't really know who their congresspeople are. Most people know who the governor is, but it doesn't attract the same kind of enthusiasm as you get out of the presidency. And we start talking about some of these, too. The competitiveness, and this is where Georgia's really changed in the past decade or so. We're more of a competitive state now, and I think people generally see that. in a way they previously sort of understood. You know, it's a one-party state. It's been like that for a long time. It switched in the early 2000s, but it's otherwise been a one-party state. And turnout generally does get lower once you get on the ballot a lot. I mean, I think generally speaking, most people understand that their districts are not particularly competitive. And you look at this, you know, our state house, state senate races out here in the Athens area, they're non-competitive races. Every one of these districts is 60% one party or the other, the way they've been gerrymandered. So yeah, there's just not as much interest, not as much information. And as you keep going down the ballot and you start losing information into the nonpartisan contest, I think it's more and more difficult for voters to decide.
So in the Senate race, Senator John Ossoff ran unopposed in his primary, but his opponent will be decided by a runoff. So it's between U.S. Representative Mike Collins and Derek Dooley, as you mentioned. What surprised you about Derek Dooley's run?
Well, he's actually not a public official. In some ways, it's not surprising. We do see a lot of that in the Republican Party in the past decade or so, people coming into politics that have no previous political experience. He's got his experience in law, and he's been a public figure in the sense that he's worked in athletics. But never having served in previous, John Ossoff too, for that matter. I mean, coming prior to the Senate, he worked in public life, sure, but he didn't hold previous elective office. It's a little unusual seeing that for a race that's kind of high up the ballot as the United States Senate. It really, in terms of elected office, it's the second highest thing you get beyond before until you get to the presidency. So it's a little bit surprising. Really kind of, and so much more of the focus there, I feel like, in the campaign environment was about Buddy Carter and Mike Collins. I say that though, thinking from the Metro Atlanta experience here. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit surprising that Dooley out-pulled Carter in that respect. You know, Buddy Carter's got a long-standing reputation in Georgia politics now. It is not a new thing in the sense that Derek Dooley is.
One race that did decide the candidate pretty handily was the Democratic ticket for Georgia governor, where Keisha Lance Bottoms won with 56% of the vote. On the other hand, the Republican race was quite different. Can you discuss a little bit about why Democrats were able to kind of coalesce around one candidate as compared to on the Republican side?
That's a great question for one. I kind of expected the Georgia Democratic race to go to a runoff as well. Whenever you have a crowded field like that, especially with several candidates that have some profile in the state, it's a little difficult to break through, especially like Mike Thurmond. He's held statewide elective office. It's been a little while since he's been in the public eye, the way Keisha Lance Bottoms has. But she had several really prominent endorsements that helped a lot. She had a significant fundraising advantage that helps a lot, right? In a way that none of the other candidates had. However, the Republican Party, you had Rick Jackson self-financing to the tune of, I can't remember the figure, but I think it was like $65 million of his own money that he dumped into his race to really push him ahead. In a way that Burt Jones did loan himself significant amounts of money, but at the same time has a fundraising. Yeah, he's got a career of fundraising as lieutenant governor, and prior to that in the state legislature, that he can rely on, as well as a network of donors and supporters he's worked with in his time in office that Rick Jackson does not have. Burt didn't give himself $60+ million either. That's really much changed the race. That's kind of the more significant thing there. Plus in the Republican primary, between Burt Jones, Brad Raffensperger, and Chris Carr, you have three statewide elected officials with longstanding history in Georgia Republican Party politics. So that went to a runoff is not at all surprising. The way it turned out, maybe a little more, but nevertheless, that significant fundraising edge that Rick Jackson gave himself with self-financing a campaign like that really did change the dynamic of the Republican Party's race for that particular office.
So getting to the local level, in the mayoral race in Athens-Clarke County, people have been kind of predicting a runoff for quite a while, because the field is also quite crowded. But in terms of a local race, what signs would you be looking for as this race continues? What challenges will the candidates face?
The fact that it's nonpartisan makes it complicated, one. And two, it's going to be all the oxygen is going to be taken out of the room by the runoffs for Senate, the runoffs for governor, and things like that. These are all races that you're going to see, as nonpartisan races, they're going to pop up on both parties' tickets. There are runoffs in the Democratic Party ticket, but not the way the Republican Party is seeing. So it's probably going to attract a significant number of voters that would otherwise not typically be voting for two, like, say, like, say, like the candidates this we're looking at typically align with the Democratic Party. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in that respect. The amount of information that's available about local candidates too. And again, both of them have a reputation, a Board of Education and County Commission here. But it's also a reputation within a smaller constituency and not as clearly connected or maybe strongly connected, sure, but the name recognition doesn't carry the same way. You're going to see, you know, upwards. I wish I could make a really honest prediction about what this is going to look like, but I'm expecting something like $20 million or more being spent on the runoff in the Republican Party between the Senate and the governor's races here. That's going to dominate so much of what this runoff looks like. It's going to be really, really hard for local candidates facing runoffs to really penetrate and get their message out to the voters, unless they take to a ground game, which is much more amenable in local politics. So we'll really have to see what happens there. We're really, really far out. I mean, the election was just on Tuesday. If we have this conversation in two more weeks, three more weeks, it's going to be very different as we get a picture of what the candidates are actually doing on the ground and how people are thinking about the mayoral runoff race.
Dr. Jeffrey Glass, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Emma.
Dr. Jeffrey Glass is a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA.
Here Now brings you the latest news from around the country.
I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them.
Seems to me that people are being responsible, and yet it keeps spreading.
I've been door knocking and making phone calls and working in offices. I'm willing to do anything for this man.
Hear the latest news as it develops on the next Here and Now from NPR News.
Welcome back to Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. When the two segregated high schools in Athens merged in 1970, high school football was a key part of civic life in the South. Local historian Mark Clegg takes on this subject in his book, The Crimson and Gold, Football and Integration in Athens, Georgia. When he published the book in 2024 with the University of Georgia Press, he had no idea that local high school librarians would pick up the book and incorporate it into a summer book club for Clark Central High School student athletes. This summer, hundreds of students will get a copy of The Crimson and Gold and will learn the tumultuous history of their own school. Clegg sat down with WUGA's Emma Auer to discuss his book and its impact on Athens youth. Here's that conversation.
Can you give us an overview of your book, The Crimson and Gold, Football and Integration in Athens, Georgia?
Sure. It's a book that covers Athens, Georgia during the entire decade of the 1960s leading into the early 1970s. It's a story about integration view largely through the prism of football, because football, of course, is very important to people in the South. And high school football back then was, I would say, even more important to individual communities than it is today. And specifically in Athens, and I lived in Athens as a child from 1964 to 1968, the Athens High Trojans, the traditional all-white school, although they were starting to admit black students on an individual basis under freedom of choice during that decade. But the Athens High Trojans played where Clark Central is now on Death Valley on Friday nights, and they would draw huge crowds. So it was a big community event. And there were most years they were a very good football team and competed extremely well, not only in the region, but also in the state of Georgia. Bernie Harris, on the other hand, only about a quarter mile away from Athens High, all-black school, about one-third the student body of Athens High, but played a very different brand of football, whereas Athens was very conservative, focused on running the ball. Bernie Harris had a high-flying aerial attack, a lot of passing, and a very colorful brand of football. So I guess those two, just putting those two teams together and relating their progress during the 1960s and ultimately the last 2 years of their existence, the two schools played each other, which was, I think, unique in the annals of Georgia high school football, in the sense that a white high school did not play its black counterpart. But in both 1968 and 69, the two met on the football field, and Athens High won both games, but Bernie Harris was very competitive. And I think the respect they earned on the playing field had a huge impact later on when the two schools were merged to form Clark Central. There were compromises made. First of all, the name Clark Central High, it was not named Athens High. The colors were crimson and gold, representing the two main colors of the two merged schools. The school newspaper was named after both legacy schools. And this was unusual in the sense that in Georgia, when this happened, when the white and black schools merged, usually the black school was subsumed, and their culture and their the team's mascots, their colors were just went away, and in essence, the black school sunk without a trace in terms of the memories and the culture. So I really think Athens was unique in that regard. The story is interwoven with what happened in the greater Athens community in the 1960s as well, because integration at the University of Georgia, of course, did not occur until 1961. You had blacks pushing for more rights in terms of their ability to shop, to vote. So the narrative is certainly a very crucial thread. The narrative of the high schools is a crucial thread in the overall story of what was happening in Athens race-wise during the 1960s. And hopefully I did a good job of that.
In your book, you trace how important the two high schools were to civic life in general for both children and adults. Can you talk a little bit more about the role of high schools during life in that era?
Well, particularly in Athens, throughout the 50s, University of Georgia football was pretty much, it was a weak decade for Georgia sports. So it was not unusual for the Bulldogs to get 25, 30,000 fans on a Saturday afternoon. And by contrast, Athens High was in the midst of a very successful run, and they would get upwards of 12,000 fans. So in terms of the civic engagement, obviously it wasn't as high as UGA, but they represented themselves well in terms of support. Bernie Harris, on the other hand, was also attracted big crowds, but it more than Athens High was a community center for black citizens. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that African Americans were simply cut off from traditional venues for things like dances or parties, any kind of social activity that you would associate with the community. So their fallback was Bernie Harris High School.
Can you tell us a little bit about the impact this book has had in the community? It is going to be read by student athletes at Clark mm-hmm. Central High School. Can you tell us a little bit about how this process started?
Yeah, I mean, it really started without me. It happened when two media specialists in the Clark Central Library, Angie Pendley and Naomi Craver, went to Avid Bookstore and found a copy of the book and read it. And I think immediately recognized that the story would have enormous appeal amongst the student body at Clark Central, because I think it points to how unique the school is. And I think so many students there were unaware of that.
Why do you think it's important for students to read this story?
Well, I think this is going to sound kind of cliche. I think they need to realize that they're standing on the shoulders of giants, the people that paved the way, the sacrifices they made. And the neat thing about that is they're all still around, or most of them are. Now, the three key most crucial, or I should say the four most crucial African-American football players, Richard Appleby, Clarence Pope, Horace King, and also Michael Thurman, who was smaller in size and was not getting the D1 offers that the other kids were. But he was an important part of that football team as well as a leader. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most interesting stories in the book is near the end of the season, the black players walked off practice, quit the team. Michael Thurman, representing the black students, met with Doc Eldridge, future mayor of Athens, white, and they agreed, hey, we're almost done with the season. Let's just get through this and hopefully win a few more games, and we'll worry about these other issues later on.
All right. Mark Clegg, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Clegg is an Athens resident and the author of The Crimson and Gold, Football and Integration in Athens, Georgia. The book will be read by hundreds of Clark Central High School student athletes this summer. You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. This week's show was produced by Emma Auer. If you missed a portion of this broadcast, Athens News Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at WUGA.org. And will be rebroadcast Monday evenings at 8. As always, thanks for listening and stay with WUGA throughout the week for the latest in-depth local news.